Hey, Jay, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Are you a fan of science fiction?
Well, Nikki, of course, and I suspect you are too. And although you and I are different in that I read most of my science fiction when I was an adolescent boy, as most of my male friends did anyway. But you know, the big authors, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Robert Heinlein, I was lost in that stuff for quite a long time. So yeah, huge fan.
Yes, I grew up in a family that lived and died for science fiction. And so when Jurassic Park came out, it was a pretty big deal. And I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a new Jurassic Park movie coming out this summer. Did you see the original back in 1993?
Yeah, of course I went to it. I loved it. And I loved the fact that the dinosaurs were dynamic, right? I mean, you see them in a museum and they're kind of standing stock still and they're impressive by their size, but it's all about the movement that is really thrilling. And of course, T-Rexes chasing Jeeps down the road. That was amazing.
So it's been a while, but if you don't remember, Jurassic Park is about this rich guy, John Hammond, who, fun fact, is played by David Attenborough's brother, Richard Attenborough. Hammond hires a team of genetic scientists to bring back extinct dinosaurs, which they do. But spoiler alert, something goes terribly wrong, and the scientists face peril and danger at the hands of T-Rex and his cold-blooded friends. Jurassic Park seemed pretty out there, right? It's science fiction. But science fiction can often go on to become real sometimes. Now, think of the communications badges the Star Trek guys and girls had on their chest. You know, you tap that, suddenly you're amazingly in communication with someone else. Now we just have a magic box we all carry on our body that can do that. We have holograms now. We're talking about going to Mars.
Yeah, you know, all of this. When we talk about the amazing pace of things, I'm reminded of another science fiction author, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, 2001, A Space Odyssey. He actually came up with three laws of predicting. And the second one was really perfect for this. He said, the only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them into the impossible. I think the impact of Jurassic Park wasn't how they did the technology to bring back the dinosaurs, but just the idea that you could actually do this. Now, since the movie, which is what, 30 years ago, new technologies are making it possible to take the idea of recreating extinct species and taking it seriously. Like, complete genomes from extinct animals exist. And then if you add tools, genetic editing tools like CRISPR-Cas9, the almost famous technology. These things can be edited and even genes from extinct animals can be mixed into the genomes of their living relatives. So it's pretty fantastic.
And it's the perfect segue to today's episode, which is about real life de-extinction, which still sounds like science fiction, but it's closer to reality than ever before. So if you believe the people at the forefront of this movement, we could see this happen in the next decade.
Yeah, even though there are still so many questions, like what are the ethical issues around this? Why do it at all? What drives those people doing it? Are these animals going to end up in zoos? Will it even work? I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it's really exciting, but it's also very controversial. You know, who gets to decide what animals come back? And can we bring back any species we choose? And today we have amazing guests to talk about this. They're kind of on both sides of the debate, like George Church, who heads up the Woolly Mammoth Project, and Ben Novak, whose dream it is to see the extinct passenger pigeon, bring them back as a conservation effort.
And like Amy Fletcher, Mikkel Sinding, they see it from a much more pragmatic point of view. So there's lots to unpack. Let's jump right in. What exactly is de-extinction?
My name is Amy Fletcher, and I focus on disruptive technologies in the biotech sector. De-extinction originally, when it first broke in the mid around 2005, was the very futuristic idea that through advances in biotechnology since the early 90s, that it might become possible to bring back relatively recently extinct species, such as the woolly mammoth or the Tasmanian tiger. Now, this is a fascinating idea. The more mainstream idea around de-extinction today is what is called genetic rescue, that you may not actually bring back a woolly mammoth, but you might be able to inject some ancient genetic diversity into extant species today.
So there's a bit of a twist here. You can recover all the genes of the woolly mammoth, but you don't have to use them to build an actual mammoth. You can just pick and choose, add some to today's elephants, make them a bit more robust, a bit more mammothy. That might be what some are thinking, but others in this field are actually going after the extinct animal itself.
And so if we pick and choose some of the genes, as you say, Jay, then is it really a woolly mammoth or is it a different animal altogether? That's a question for George Church, the head of that mammoth project, and we're going to ask him that in a little bit. It's interesting Amy doesn't really come down on one side of this debate or the other. She's skeptical, but like so many people, she finds the idea almost irresistible.
Part of it, I think, if you look at science fiction, of course, we have the trope of Jurassic Park. So it's an idea that's just intrinsically fascinating. And I know that some scientists can get a bit irritated with that, but I understand why so many of us just find the idea to be really compelling. The other issue with the fascination, I think particularly for the woolly mammoth, it's a charismatic species. And dinosaurs, per Jurassic Park, we know they're a really long time ago. So my understanding is that it would be virtually impossible because of the age of the DNA to truly bring back a dinosaur. We did live among our ancestors. We did live among woolly mammoths, so to speak. So we know that that was an ice age extinction and very early man. So I think there's something compelling there, that this is a species that while ancient, we can sort of see ourselves in relationship to it. And I also think from maybe a perhaps a more serious point of view, it's compelling because we know that the ice age was a primary driver, as well as human hunting, of that species extinction. And we're kind of facing, however many thousands of years later, both of those problems in our contemporary world. So I think there's a variety of reasons that the woolly mammoth in particular is such an iconic species for the de-extinction advocates.
No kidding. Nikki, imagine, and this is science fiction probably, but let's say in like 40 or 50 years, just like people go to Churchill, Manitoba today to see polar bears, you could go somewhere in Nunavut or Yukon and you could get on a bus and trundle off into the wilderness and see a herd of woolly mammoth. That would be absolutely unreal.
It would be unreal. I'd probably cry, actually. I think when I lived in the Yukon, I'd actually seen places where woolly mammoth tusks have melted out of riverbanks and, you know, held them in my hand and never dreamed at the time that I could see one in real life. Like Amy said, it's an iconic species, but it might not be the easiest one to bring back, especially compared to those that are more recently extinct.
Yeah, that's right. The time difference is important because it has an impact on the quality of how much of the animal's DNA is left. Mikkel Sinding is a postdoc in paleogenomics at the University of Copenhagen. He completely agrees that getting good DNA is a challenge, but it's not the only challenge.
So the biggest problem is actually that as soon as an animal dies, you start to decompose, and the same does your cells. And that means your DNA gets completely fragmented. And that makes it very hard to assemble a genome again, especially when the thing is extinct, because when you have like a modern human being, you have other human beings where you can see how should this puzzle be put back together. But you actually don't have that for something extinct. Then you have to rely on closely related things, but they are never completely the same. So you can never fully reconstruct, at least not yet, and there's no good theories of how to do it yet, you cannot reconstruct an extinct species genome completely. And there's quite a few other small things, or big things, to be honest, like the microbiome. So, you know, every organism works together with the environment using a whole tool case of bacteria. And all these small interactions, there's no record of those, of how they interacted with the genomes precisely. Again, we have to rely on closely related species to see it. So we can imagine we have a good picture to recreate an extinct species, but we never have the full picture.
Man, I love that microbiome stuff. So as you can see, it is complicated on every level. Before we go any further, though, it might be helpful to break down the process scientists are using to eventually, hopefully, achieve de-extinction. Here is Ben Novak. He's the lead scientist at the California nonprofit Revive and Restore.
There are five basic steps to de-extinction. Step one, we get the DNA, we sequence the genome. We compare it to the genome of its living relative. We figure out all of the mutations, you know, that would help recreate that. Step two is the real new groundbreaking technology, using things like CRISPR-Cas9 to rewrite the actual DNA in the living cell of the relative of our extinct species. So for the passenger pigeon, it would be the band-tailed pigeon. We'd take some cells and gene edit mutations from the extinct species. And then step three is taking those gene edited cells and using a reproductive technology to make a living animal out of them. So for mammals, we can use cloning. There's a variety of ways to do this with different species. With birds, we have to use something called germline transfer that has been made for chickens. We have to develop these. But once you have some animals actually being bred through that technology and you produce several of them, you move to the captive breeding phase and then move to step five, getting those animals back into the wild. And those are the five essential steps of going from DNA to a completely restored extinct species in the wild.
So lots of steps. Steps one and two sound relatively doable given the current technology and lots of moolah. The rest of it sounds pretty daunting from a scientific perspective.
Especially the time frame to me. But at the same time, this is a science project that is completely captivating, bringing back a mammoth, passenger pigeon. What about the dodo? But that's why the Jurassic Park idea is so popular. And I think, Nikki, right now there's maybe even a dozen candidate animals and birds that have been identified as ripe for de-extinction. So who chooses? You're going to choose. Nikki,
yes.
I grant you the right to choose the next animal for de-extinction. What would it be?
Okay, well, I used to work at the Beringia Museum in the Yukon, which is an Ice Age museum, and I was always kind of fascinated with the Arctic camels, in particular the Yukon giant camel, which is about 3.5 meters high. It lived about 1 million years ago. And what I think is so cool is that a lot of people don't know camels originated in North America, like in the Arctic. And so that's what gave them the ability to live in deserts, is some of the adaptations they developed there. So that's what I would bring back.
How about a pigeon? Don't tell me it's not exciting. This particular pigeon is. Ben Novak, who just explained to us the five steps of de-extinction, is heading up the Great Passenger Pigeon Comeback. He's almost been single-handedly leading that effort. And the next obvious question is, why?
Well, there are a number of reasons that we want to bring back the passenger pigeon, the project that I personally lead and have a deep passion for. The short answer is that this is a forestry conservation project. Restoring passenger pigeons will be a huge benefit to sustaining biodiversity, as well as helping carbon cycles and overall bioproductivity for the forests of the eastern United States and Canada.
Okay, so the first thing I want to know is, what the heck is a passenger pigeon? Like, Does it hop a ride on the carrier pigeon? Like, is the carrier pigeon the Uber for the passenger pigeon?
And separate from the driver pigeon is the passenger pigeon. Is that what you're getting at?
Oh, God.
But anyway, Nikki, little background on the passenger pigeon, because it does deserve respect. There were billions. And when they migrated in the numbers of, you know, tens of millions and landed in forests, they basically destroyed the forest, not only breaking off branches, but leaving their poop everywhere. And that actually allowed the forest to continually renew itself. But of course, people just slaughtered them for their meat, and the last one died in 1914. Ben Novak wanted to hatch the first generation of new passenger pigeons, get this, in like 3 years from now, and begin releasing them into the wild sometime after. But he's changed that a little bit, still another 5 to 7 years away, partly because the technology to grow a bird embryo is very different than a mammal.
Every group of animals has a very unique reproductive biology, and birds lay eggs, which is a challenge for cloning. So for birds, we actually have to innovate a wholly different kind of process. And the process that we'll use for birds was actually first achieved in about 2005 with the domestic chicken. And while it's a process that has allowed people to create genetically engineered chickens for the last nearly two decades, it's something people have not used yet for wild birds. So we have a little bit of work to adapt this technology for, say, a pigeon, to recreate a passenger pigeon, but we're moving towards that right now. And it's a technology that actually, if we literally crack this egg for the passenger pigeon, we open up the doorway to a whole suite of new opportunities to save endangered birds as well.
So, you know, there's tons of passion there. Ben's motivation is clearly conservation. It probably remains to be seen if his hopes of bringing back a whole forest ecosystem are achievable. Bringing back one or two birds? Sure, that seems reasonable, but millions enough to darken the sky? I guess we'll see. But there's more to it than that. Clearly, scientists who are at the forefront of these movements, you know, this major pioneering technology, have a deep connection and feeling of purpose, especially when you're talking about something like de-extinction. You know, it taps into that childlike wonder we all have for the natural world. Here's Ben again.
I think there are a lot of reasons why people are fascinated by de-extinction. There's a sense of wonder that comes from bringing back something that we've never seen. There's a sense of moral obligation, actually, with species that we know we've driven to extinction, like the passenger pigeon, that we can have some sort of justice for that species by bringing them back and offer ourselves some redemption in the act. But in truth, I think there's just an inner core to being human that is connected to wilderness and the rest of species on this planet. And the woolly mammoth is a great example. Some of the very first art that Europeans ever made 30,000 years ago were cave paintings and effigies of woolly mammoths and these huge creatures they once lived with. And so why would we want to see a woolly mammoth again? Well, it invokes something very carnal and primal to our ancestry and who we used to be that could be something beautiful for our future.
Finally, we get to the woolly mammoth, the most talked about, the most sensational of all the de-extinction projects.
But there is a small plot twist. The animal that they are trying to create, they are no longer calling it the woolly mammoth. And we have the head of that project, George Church, with us here today.
I'm George Church. I'm professor at Harvard and MIT, and my laboratory and I do research on transformative technologies that tend to be exponential, reading and writing DNA, cells, organs, ecosystems.
Can I start by asking you, are you calling it a mammoth or an Arctic elephant?
We prefer Arctic elephant. I mean, it's not ruled out that we could make a nearly perfect genetically, epigenetically, and behaviorally to the extent that we know them. But I think just something that an elephant that has a new range would be adequate.
So why do you want to bring back the mammoth?
Well, just to be clear, our fairly long-term goals are just to bring back genetic diversity into the elephant lineage from the mammoth. We're really looking at ways to achieve rewilding for new environments with endangered species in particular, in this case, the Arctic elephants. That's our main goal, is to come up with technologies that could be useful for, you know, veterinary agriculture and possibly even medical use, but especially endangered species.
Walk me through the science you'll be using to bring back this Arctic elephant.
And we start with kind of a background of elephant because those have the right genetic and epigenetics. They're very, very close. Asian elephants are closer to mammoths than either one of them is to African elephants. But even African elephants are close enough they probably interbred or could interbreed. So anyway, we take one of those as a starting point, living elephant cell, and we introduce editing machinery, which is typically proteins and nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, that will precisely change to the ancestral state or to some new state that provides virus resistance or different tusk lengths or you name it. From the point that we have edited and checked the cell that we've been editing, we take the nucleus, DNA containing part of the cell, and we can put it into an embryo, or we can develop the cell to get gametes in the lab. And then those can be brought to term, meaning to baby elephants, by a combination of methods that have been developed mostly for human and some veterinary use, like in vitro fertilization, which takes you forward from the gametes, and preemie technology that allows you to go further and further back in development, so sort of past the midpoint of gestation in the mammalian pregnancy. Then it's once it's born, then there's some behavioral training that has to be done, which we collectively have experience in due to the orphan state of elephants due to hunters and poachers.
So in other words, because they won't have a mom per se or parents of that species, you'll help them socialize and grow in a way that makes sense for what you've seen in, say, orphaned Indian elephants, for example.
A lot of the orphans are African elephants as well, but they probably, the first set will have mothers and other tribe members. They're close enough. They will be close enough genetically that we'll make sure that they're recognized. But there's also training methods that have been developed for the orphans that don't depend heavily on the herd. And we'll employ a mixture of those. And as we scale up, we'll have to use more and more the surrogate, using physical specimens rather than the actual parents. This was been developed for many rewilding efforts. For example, the California condor, they use hand puppets to teach them about how to eat and so forth.
And do you hope to make more than one and then have them breed to develop a herd? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We want to scale up cautiously, but they need company. Most of the scale up, I think, will probably occur by having this artificial assisted reproduction, because we don't want to interfere with the reproduction of the current endangered mothers. But we think that it will scale up in a way that's beneficial to the species.
You know, Nikki, George Church is talking about Indian elephants that they would use as surrogate mothers. And the fact is, they're not exactly plentiful. So they don't really want to occupy the womb of an Indian elephant to try and make their Arctic elephant. So look, technically, it's no longer the woolly mammoth they're trying to create. It's an Arctic elephant. Is that like splitting hairs? Like Amy Fletcher said, is going to be indistinguishable? See, I wonder, we all have like 1% to 2% of, or most of us have 1% to 2% of Neanderthal DNA. Does that mean we're not fully human? Does that mean we're like hybrid?
Hey, speak for yourself.
Like if we were brought back from the dead, people would be mad because we're not 100% human. I think that these are arguments that the general public may not care that much about. If it looks like a mammoth, it is a mammoth. But whether you need 100% mammoth, I don't know.
Yeah, you definitely need that thick fat layer, though, if you're going to live in the cold. But to bring Amy Fletcher back in, that technical distinction is nothing compared to the ethical and legal Pandora's box that this process opens up.
Technically, it will arguably be a hybrid species. So again, from a scientific point of view and being true to your facts, that's very important. And I acknowledge that as a social scientist. I think for most of us, though, it's going to look enough like a woolly mammoth if it actually were to happen, that that distinction will likely fall away. While it's a controversial idea, the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation and Nature, they have already published some guidelines. Hypothetically, you bring back a woolly mammoth. Well, the second it is born, it's an endangered species. And it's covered under an extraordinary number of both national and global regulations. So there's some tension there because the biotech industry, of course, while I think it can do a lot of good, is interested in profit. But the second a woolly mammoth is born, technically it is the ultimate endangered species at that point. And so you have to consider that tension. This is a legal area that is so complex right now, and it's something that lawyers are and regulators are thinking about, but my sense is that until you're actually faced with a Tasmanian tiger or a woolly mammoth that needs to walk around, we won't quite be able to resolve that. Hypothetically, we can't resolve it. I think it's going to need an actual species that then a decision has to be made.
You know, Nikki, I have to admit, I'd never suspected that one day I'd be sitting here listening to someone talk about the legal and ethical issues surrounding the birth of a woolly mammoth.
Yeah, it all sounds pretty futuristic. And don't forget, as Mikhail Sindig said, there's the important issue of the microbiome. These are the bacteria and other microbes that colonize the gut. And this is something I just haven't heard a lot about.
The microbiome is, you know, a topic undergoing huge investigations right now, especially ancient microbiomes. And right now, the picture is sort of that the microbiome is like your second genome. So there is as much information and function in your microbiome as in your personal genetics. So it's going to be super important. The real question is then, to what degree you can swap, you know, you can steal a microbiome from something related. And you can modify it a bit. Like if you say a mammoth, if you take an Indian elephant and then you take something else living in the Arctic, like a reindeer or a muskox, and then you sort of see, is there something in these herbivores that you sort of need to live in the Arctic that the Indian elephant don't have? But it's, you know, it's all speculative.
So much we don't actually know and are trying to find out. And, you know, even animal welfare people are a little bit concerned about these proposed experiments to bring back an extinct animal, because the individual animals are actually part of an experiment and they're concerned whether the animal's welfare is going to be primary to the people doing the experiments. Amy Fletcher sees this going in one of two directions.
I suppose the worst case scenario is that you have one or two examples of a species brought back, and they're kind of shoved in some sort of park or zoo, and a lot of money is being made. And then over time, unfortunately, even with a resurrected woolly mammoth, you probably would see a drop off in interest after a certain point. I mean, we know that the moon landing was a brilliant technological and cultural achievement. By the mid-1970s, we've already been to the moon. Whatever, I'm not going to watch any more of these launches. So you would have a really worst case scenario if that resurrected species is only one or two cases living alone and lonely in a zoo or a park, and it becomes a spectacle. And after a time, human interest moves on to the next big thing. I think that would be extraordinarily sad. I think it would be deeply unethical, and I don't think it would really move the science that much more forward. The best case scenario, which is what I would hope to see, is that these conversations between ethicists and scientists and corporations and lawyers and social scientists continue in a very vibrant way and a very transparent way. And that these technologies, while you might need one or two Tasmanian tigers or woolly mammoths to lead the charge, the real point of rescuing and improving the health of our modern global ecosystem is the real thing that engages people. So I think, yeah, it's kind of an interesting position we're in. It's still prospective, but there is progress being made. And I think you have the possibility of two extremes. It's either going to go very badly, or it could actually be a way to bring back some hope into the field of environmentalism, which right now, unfortunately, is kind of a litany of doom. And we need to listen, but it gets hard to have hope. And I think de-extinction at its finest brings hope to the discussion.
Amy Fletcher's comments to me, Nikki, really illustrate just how complex this is. And we don't often get to hear how complex it is. You know, woolly mammoth coming back, passenger pigeon darkening the skies, spectacular single images. But when you dig down, like Amy Fletcher did, you find that there's a lot of risk. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that's something that really struck me is we talk about these projects, but these are real living beings we're talking about bringing back. You know, she talked about the potential for them to be lonely. And I think that would be really sad. I mean, bringing back one or two animals that are used to living in a herd and then just having them exist on their own. It's sad.
On the other hand, she points out that conservation, I guess, needs all the help it can get, and this might be inspirational if it's done right, because, as you said, I mean, if mammoths are like elephants, they're highly social, and having two might not be enough. You know, I can't make up my mind about de-extinction, honestly.
I'm having trouble also.
Because I think that resources are being poured into it, and the public image of it is quite different, it seems to me, from all of the technological challenges. And when you're projecting out, as Ben Novak is, decades and decades and decades, he said that he won't be around to see the first passenger pigeons probably, then you wonder if the momentum can be sustained.
It might be fair to also talk about the fact that these technologies that they're developing, they're not just for de-extinction or even for conservation. Some of the technologies might lend themselves to helping in other fields. For example, if you can take a skin cell and develop an egg that would grow in a woman in her ovaries and produce an unlimited supply, that could really help people facing fertility issues that have to go through the grueling process of in vitro fertilization. So there is other promise associated with these technologies. It was interesting to learn about those things from George Church, and you know what else he told me, Jay?
What?
So Michael Crichton, who wrote Jurassic Park, used to be his student at Harvard Medical School, so it was interesting to get into that with him a little bit. And he pointed out a major flaw in the original Jurassic Park movie, which was, you know, how the scientists used food laced with lysine to control the dinosaurs? Like, they needed this food or they would die. And it turns out lysine can be found in a lot of things, so that in no way would be a good way to contain dinosaurs. George has some ideas of how you would do that properly, but you'll have to ask him about that. It's no wonder they got out, Jay. It's no wonder the dinosaurs went everywhere.
So if you're going to throw little tidbits like that at me, I have one of my own. The executive producer of the new Jurassic Park movie has invested in the woolly mammoth or the Arctic elephant de-extinction.
You know, this smells like a new franchise to me, Jay, where there's animals of all eras. You could have Jurassic, Cretaceous, Pleistocene Park coming to you next year at your theater.
And let's not stick it in a theater. Let's make it augmented reality so that you are there. That's the impossible dream. This is the end of today's episode, and you know what? Our next episode of Anthropomania is the last one of season 2. It feels like we barely started by checking out wildlife documentaries and going through insects and trash animals, and here we are.
And you know, we are going to go out with a bang. We're going from extinct animals to something you can literally find everywhere. They're in us, they're all around us. The fungi. Did you know there are morel wars right now here in Canada? People are bribed, intimidated, and super protective of their foraging spots. Those morel mushrooms, they're a hot commodity.
We are finding that mushrooms are having their moment in the sun, although, of course, fungi like to grow in the dark. Today's guests, we appreciate them joining us, Amy Fletcher, Mikhail Sinding, Ben Novak, and George Church. And check our show notes for more information on their work. And as always, please leave us a review if you like the show. And bye for now.
See you next time.